Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk on the Other Side. And today we are going to be looking at the impact of economic opportunity and racism. We are joined today by Evelyn Burnett. I'm very pleased to introduce Evelyn to you. She is Vice President of Economic Opportunity at Cleveland Neighborhood Progress, an intermediary whose mission it is. Well, I tell you what, Evelyn, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you.
Why don't you tell us what the mission is of the firm that you work with? I think you're probably more expert than I am.
Sure. Cleveland Neighborhood Progress is a near 30-year-old community development intermediary whose mission is really to foster communities of choice and opportunity throughout Cleveland.
And when you say communities of choice and opportunity, what do you mean?
Livable, attractive places, so not places where folks are just surviving, but places where folks are thriving and equitably thriving. So places with good schools, good housing, good amenities, good places to sort of live, work, and play.
Now, as you heard me say a moment ago, you and I are going to be talking about the impact of racism on economic opportunity. But before we launch into that part of the conversation, I would like for you to share with the audience a story that you shared with me that's a couple of years old that involved a police officer by the name of Michael Brillo. Can you share that story?
Sure. I think it was back in 2012, November, there was a police chase that ended in the shooting death of two unarmed black Cleveland residents. You know, they were fleeing police. A police chase ensued. You know, I can't remember the amount of cars that got involved in the chase, but there were many, many, many cars involved in the chase. It went throughout the city of Cleveland into an inner ring, predominantly black suburb, East Cleveland, and ends in a hail of gunfire. And this particular officer, Michael Brillo, kind of emerges in this story as this person that mounts the hood of the car. And I think there were a total of something like 137 shots or 147 shots total. And Michael Brillo becomes this infamous character in this unfortunate tragedy that mounts the hood of the car and shoots into the car. And essentially, after a very, very, very long legal process, he was found not guilty. And, you know, I think that it was another chapter in a series of unfortunate legal decisions that had these significant racial implications that I think is driving a lot of our work locally.
The as I was going over the article that you shared with me, I think it was like something like 60 police cars.
Yes, it was a lot.
That, I mean, I don't know about folks listening, but when I think about a lot of police cars, I think about four or five or three.
Yeah.
So 60 plus is really hard to kind of wrap the brain around. And the visual of this police officer jumping onto the hood of their car, firing at least 15 rounds through their windshield for a total of 137 rounds of bullets, and this particular officer being found not guilty is just stunning.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it was stunning. And I think, you know, there's a lot of news articles about this, you know. Tragedy One talks about there being more than 100 police that participated in a 22-minute police chase, right? And it was just like you kind of think about a city like Cleveland, you know, where you expect law enforcement to protect and serve. And when there's 60 cars and 100 police officers chasing two unarmed people, ending in a hail of 137 bullets, you're right. It's a really difficult thing to wrap your mind around.
The Cleveland had its own reaction, and certainly I know you became very involved, not only with your work, but also with an organization entitled Hack Cleveland. Tell us what that is.
Sure. Hack Cleveland is essentially a meetup group. It's not more formal than that, though. It's becoming more formal because it's become an outlet for response and action. And actually, we came together. The Brelo case, again, was in, or the shooting occurred in 2012. But then in 2014, Tamir Rice was shot by Cleveland police, you know, another unarmed black male, 12 years old, in a park with a toy gun. A caller, you know, calls the police and says, there's this guy in a park, and, you know, he's got this gun, he's waving this gun. I don't think it's real, but, you know, he's scaring people. And so two officers arrive on the scene, and, you know, as the story is told, within 2 seconds, they mount the curb and kill Tamir Rice. And I think that it was, you know, personally, I had been involved in a variety of ways, and just a lot of the activism happening around the country. I certainly don't consider myself an activist, nor do I consider myself an organizer, more just as a concerned citizen and a person of color for whom these things really have deep psychological impact, right?
Of course.
And so I had spent a little bit of time in Ferguson and just, you know, just watching these scenes play out around the country, right? You saw what's happening in New York and just everywhere, North Carolina. So after the Tamir Rice, there was a number of us, and I would say young professionals, kind of loosely defined, that were just fed up. Like, we just could not... we cannot take these stories that we're hearing over and over, because the tragedy was that they were becoming pretty commonplace, which I think, you know, does a lot to your psychology and just your spirit and the ability to be resilient from these sorts of tragedies. So Hack Cleveland came together just as a group of people. I think, as I recall this story, I was not able to go to work after one of the cases. I can't even remember which one at this point, but you know, I called my boss and I said, I can't make it to work. Like, I don't know, call it mental health day, like whatever you need to call it, but I won't be there tomorrow. And it was some friends, organizers in from Ferguson, and I, you know, it was a sort of just a call to some friends and colleagues to meet at a black owned business that evening. And we just kind of talked about, like, how fed up we were, and like how we all feel like we have a pretty keen analysis of the problems, but that we were feeling like a lot of our leaders, white and black, just weren't doing anything. So we had a variety of ideas that evening about what we wanted to do, and one that emerged was a social justice hackathon. You know, and 99% of us had no idea what that meant, but we were connected with a wonderful woman out of that was based in D.C., a Bangladeshi refugee who was an astronautical engineer, but was a community organizer for 10 years. And so we call her a little bit of a unicorn, right, because those things just don't go together. And she helped us over the course of a few weeks put together what we called a social justice hackathon. And, you know, it was a difficult thing to message to the community, because people are like, what is hacking? Isn't that bad?
Exactly.
How does social justice and hacking go together? And, you know, I think, quite honestly, a lot of people showed up because of just personal relationships. Evelyn or others that were a part of this are asking me to come to this thing. And, you know, we wanted to message that this was very different from your typical hackathon. This is not a Silicon Valley, you know, a young computer engineers hacking away throughout the night, drinking Mountain Dew and eating pizza, right? Like, that's not what we were trying to do. We were really trying to bring the community together to talk about the problems that are plaguing their community, and to see if there were tech solutions to some of those problems. And so over the course of 2 days, and, you know, we wanted to get folks home by 8 in the evening on Friday and, you know, a reasonable start on Saturday, and we ended Saturday evening. So, again, very different from your typical hackathon, to come up with some solutions to problems in their community. And that's what was birthed that evening. And so the group's about a year old now, and the work has evolved a whole lot, where we're trying to think about tech and the digital economy in a way that is inclusive and equitable, because I think that the social justice lens continues to remind us that there's not a lot of folks of color in tech. You're hearing a lot of big tech companies and, or, you know, the Googles, the Amazons, the giants kind of talking about their diversity issues, but you know, we see it as a place where people of color can be marginalized again, and we're trying to do all that we can to ensure that that doesn't happen, that our communities are really informed about what's happening in the digital economy, its evolution, how quickly its evolution is happening. But at our core, we remind ourselves that really we came together in response to social injustice.
Now, in your work with the organization, with Cleveland Neighborhood Progress, your goals, which are many, your the hats that you wear are many, and you're engaged in programming and integrating education, leadership building, community engagement, workforce, and economic development. I'm sort of running out of breath. Micro enterprise development and asset building into the community development industry. As you hear me report back to you all of the various things that you are responsible for, and you put the social justice lens on it, and you put your own personal and professional, and because you live in the world, awareness of racism, how does this sort of inform the passion that you bring to your work on a regular basis?
I mean, this is reality for me, right? Like, it's not, it work often doesn't feel like work. And when you say it back, it reminds me that it does sound pretty overwhelming and to some extent, you know, euphoric, and that, like, how does one achieve those things? But, you know, I live in the community. I'm from the community. I drive down the streets that we're trying to change. I wrestle with these ideas of, you know, development, not displacement. You know, I wrestle with this notion of gentrification, but all of it is done through, or I try to do it through a social justice lens and also a racial equity and inclusion lens, which is something very new to community development. My entire portfolio that I lead at Neighborhood Progress is new to community development. Community development was an industry that for decades was focused on the built environment, you know, commercial and residential real estate development.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
That's where the money flowed from the federal government, from a lot of private sources, from a lot of philanthropic sources. And so I heard myself in a meeting a few weeks ago characterize it as we're trying to sort of turn the Titanic. And I joked with the colleagues in the meeting that when I said that to my mom one evening, I said, "Oh, I feel like I'm trying to turn the Titanic." She said, "She and I thought it was pretty clever." And she reminded me that the Titanic sunk, right? And so, you know, you could take that metaphor in a whole lot of places, that this is a new body of work and that it often feels like it could sink because it feels like a lot to try to manage, and it feels very ambitious, but it also, at least for me personally, feels like an imperative. It's a moral imperative to this work. It's an economic imperative to this work. You know, it's not just a kind of touchy-feely charity, let's help those people over there.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think particularly when a lot of people of color are in this work, and you're looking at data set after data set, report after report, you know, brief after brief, that is talking about the disproportionate impacts of policies, programming, and funding that is disproportionately impacting people of color. It's personal, right? So when you're talking about a person trying to obtain a GED for a better life, well, you're talking about my brother, like my actual brother, right? Like not like my brother in spirit,
understood.
But my actual brother, okay. My actual cousin, or, you know, and so the work is personal. And I think that, you know, there's not only is it personal, but it feels maddening often, because I think that the more your eyes are open, the crazier you feel. So,
well, you know, I have to agree with you that the more you your eyes are open, certainly the crazier it feels. It kind of, I was going to say, kind of doesn't make sense, but it really doesn't make sense. But in fact, it remains true today, perhaps more than, perhaps less than, but true nevertheless, that race does continue to be a predictor of a person's life style, of their outcomes, of their lifestyle outcomes, of their opportunities, of their educational path, of their professional path. Just the color of their skin is still very much a predictor and a determinant.
Mm-hmm.
Is it more so today, or is it less so today?
You know, it's a tricky question, and one that myself and a lot of my colleagues and friends wrestle with every day. I found myself in a really sobering conversation last week with some pretty seasoned folks that I respect a whole lot, where we were trying to make this argument for the imperative to apply a racial equity inclusion lens and inclusion lens to community development, and it was people of color asking the question, and more than people of color, black folks asking the question or calling in the question, well, is it really race or is it something else? And I went through a training, just an introductory training, 4 hours of a 2-day training by an organization out of Greensboro, North Carolina, called the Racial Equity Institute, where unlike any training that I've ever participated in or any report I've ever read, where they lay out essentially every indicator in our society and the disproportionate outcomes for people of color. And more than for people of color, for black folks, right? So it almost is at a point where I feel like I see so much data, right, to prove that, yes, in fact, race is a predictor of a lot of things. Your zip code is a predictor of a lot of things. And it's not to say that, like, other folks aren't struggling, that white folks aren't struggling, you know, that our economy didn't hurt, you know, that the recession didn't hurt us all, because that's true. But, you know, it's hard to answer the question, is it worse now or was it worse then? Have we seen significant strides? Absolutely, you know. But it almost feels absurd to say, like, well, we're not getting hosed anymore or we're not enslaved anymore. Like, those things weren't right then. They were atrocities then and they're atrocities now. But I certainly think that it's an atrocity that black women fear for their sons. Every time they walk out the door, you know, many black women fear for their sons every time they walk out the door because they're not sure if a police encounter will end in a fatality, mm-hmm. right? And that black women face that reality more than white women, right? And I talk to mother after mother after mother, regardless of income, regardless of education, right? Like, regardless of the strides that they've made in their lives, that fear is ever present for them. And that's not to say that it's for all, but it's certainly to say it's for a disproportionate amount of us. I mean, here in the city of Cleveland, there was a report released last year that talked about Cleveland's infant mortality rate being worse than many third world countries. And again, the disproportionate impact of of infant mortality in communities of color, more specifically for African American women, regardless of income or educational attainment, right? And I think that those are just not statistics that you can dismiss, because what was really shocking for a lot of my colleagues and friends was the income and the educational attainment that African American women in the city of Cleveland were experiencing higher rates of infant mortality than non-educated white women, right? So I think that it calls into the question for me, regardless of how much education you get and how much money you make, your race, or you know, the construct of your race still has these impacts that are these outcomes for you. And so what do you do with that? And for me, it becomes a sad state of affairs when we're asking the question, well, is it race? You know, and you just show indicator after indicator where you're seeing this disproportionality. So,
Evelyn Burnett, vice president of, I want to say sort of like half of Cleveland, but that's probably wrong. Vice president at Cleveland Neighborhood Progress. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'd like to talk more specifically about the many disparities that you are confronted with on a daily basis that, again, lead back specifically, as you've just said, to the fact of race, regardless of the other quote-unquote indicators that, in theory, would suggest otherwise. This is Pamela Brewer, folks. You're listening to Mind Talk. We'll be right back. Evelyn Burnett, Vice President at Cleveland Neighborhood Progress. Evelyn, we were talking a moment ago even about the health disparities, and I'm reminded, I think it was Robert Wood Johnson that recently did, Robert Wood Johnson Foundation that recently did some studies on health disparities or length of life according to zip codes. And In there, same thing, that depending on where you lived, and certainly in communities that are perceived to be of color more than others, your life expectancy was actually reduced.
Yep.
It's stunning. It's angering. It's more words than I can probably politely say. let's talk about your sense of the racial health disparities, specifically in Cleveland. As you go about your work every day, how does your work specifically impact on addressing that issue?
So as a part of this applying of racial equity and inclusion lens to community development, we're really in a process now of trying to specifically identify these disparities, because I think that, you know, we were reminded in a conversation that I referenced earlier that there is a question, black, white, or other, of is it race? And so we need to really cite some tangible examples that, yes, in fact, race is a predictor of many outcomes. So, you know, the one that you just mentioned, that same study, I think maybe in conjunction with the Race Matters initiative, you know, did a hyper-local look at those, at the life expectancy. And for the city of Cleveland, they, you know, they compared a neighborhood called Central, which has, I believe, the highest concentration of public housing in the state of Ohio, and Lyndhurst, in an outer ring suburb of Cleveland. And the male life expectancy difference was 27 years.
Oh, my. 27,
right? 27 years.
Years.
Like, you know, that's not five. Or you're talking about 27 years. And so, you know, once you hear these statistics, I think it's important to dig deeper, right? So why is that? Access to healthy, fresh and healthy foods, you know, access to quality housing, you know, what is behind that? You know, educational attainment, income, all those things. Well, what's behind those numbers? And so we're in this process of really trying to identify the root causes. And, you know, the what's interesting is that, like, there's a lot of data out there, national data, and I'm beginning to really understand the importance of data, good data, and good data analysis, not just for the sake of data analysis, right, but to truly inform our decision making, our programmatic efforts, our policy and advocacy efforts. You know, just a few that we're paying a lot of attention to here at Neighborhood Progress and beginning to gather hyper-local data, which is important, right? Like, it's one thing to say that the life expectancy for Black males and white males is significantly different, right? Like, you know, the average is 25 years or something like that. Well, what, you know, as an intermediary, if you're a community development organization, whomever, what you're to do about those numbers matters, and that local context matters. So we're looking at things like the persistence and exacerbation of health inequality as it relates to communities of color, these racial health disparities that you mentioned. You know, a topic that's starting to gain some momentum as a part of the national discourse and certainly here locally is climate resiliency. You know, we talked about climate change for a long time, and we found ourselves caught up in this question again, like, is it climate change? That's not real. That's, you know, and it was a lot of it was really political, but we know that minority populations are disproportionately vulnerable to the effects of climate change. What is that, like, what does that mean? It sounds like really scientific kind of doublespeak, but like in communities of color, when it's too hot and you do not have access to air conditioning, what do? When it's too cold, right? Like that stuff, it's not climate just for climate's sake. When you don't have the appropriate tree canopy, right? And there are actual interventions and actual programming and you know, redirection of funding and those sorts of things that can change those outcomes for folks. You know, we have to talk about the prevalence of high poverty neighborhoods throughout many of our urban centers. It's an uncomfortable topic for folks, but we're talking about deadly police encounters in communities of color, and you know, the trust building associated with that. And then, you know, the topic that folks seem a little bit more comfortable discussing. And I know that I struggle with what it means because I think it can be very, very, very quickly diluted and you find yourself talking about something different, is diversity. And so when you look across a lot of urban-serving organizations writ large, right, and I'll speak specifically to the city of Cleveland, but having worked in many other cities across the country, I made this observation as well. But the ability to work in communities of color without people of color is perplexing to me. So, you know, for example, if you have a community development corporation in a majority-minority neighborhood, but there's not a single person of color on the board or staff, you know, I find that kind of peculiar. And I question that organization's ability to adequately serve the population that they intend to serve. And it's not to say that, like, white folks can't serve Black folks and vice versa, but the ability to connect and have impact and have familiarity. Like, those things are real. And it almost is, it's almost laughable to think of an all-Black organization serving a predominantly white Cleveland suburb.
Indeed.
You know, you first would ask the question, like, well, what would you be doing, right? We're not talking about a restaurant with Black folks in the back, right? Because we're used to that. But, you know, this idea that you have organizations across industries working in communities of color without, you know, some of the just inherent expertise, experience, familiarity, that I think is really important to be able to adequately serve those populations.
You know, as you're talking, I'm reminded of a board I was on, which shall remain nameless, but the mission was really to serve the poor and uneducated and sort of ill-prepared for life. And mm-hmm. the board, I think it was like a 20-plus board membership, was primarily upper income, ridiculously upper income, white males, then white females. I don't remember if there were any Black males on the board. There may have been, I just don't remember. And then there were two Black women.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, just the whole sense that you're right. I mean, the ability to connect to what it actually feels like to believe that you're safer living on the street than in a shelter, that's just so far, you know, different from their experience that they can't really understand what that's about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When you talk about racial health disparities, you know, the other thing that I think about that I talked about periodically is the difference in diagnostics when it comes to people of color, comes to women. I mean, there's the person who's making the diagnosis is a human being, and so they come with their own prejudices and their own biases. And the idea that two people with essentially the same behaviors could have a very different mental health diagnosis, even, which then suggests a very different course of treatment, it's pretty astounding and still true in today's world.
Mm-hmm.
It's scary.
It is. Very.
When you talk about the Black folks who were questioning whether or not it was race, you sounded pretty annoyed, perplexed. What's that like for you as you experience that?
Oh, it is tricky. you know, on one hand, it's annoying. On another hand, you're right. It is perplexing. It's not the place where I assume that we're going to start the conversation, right? I always assume, like, we're the baseline of understanding. I always assume a common baseline of understanding. Now, what we're going to do about it is the question that I usually am prepared to start to talk about, right? And how we encourage each other and how we remind each other of our resilience throughout our history in America, right? Like, I expect to start from there. I don't expect to start from is it race? And I know that I had to remind myself in that, maybe not in that conversation, but subsequent to that conversation, that I am inundated with hard data about these disparities all day, every day, right? And I have immersed myself probably to my own detriment sometimes, right? I'm kind of feeding the beast a little bit. But in these numbers every day, and then I also live in these numbers, right? So I don't live in a Cleveland suburb. I live in an essentially all-Black neighborhood in the city of Cleveland that has the potential to experience a lot of redevelopment, and some will call it gentrification. You know, I've been called a Black gentrifier, right? Like, because I made an investment in this neighborhood. But I think more than annoyed and perplexed, it feels hurtful sometimes, right? Because you're in this conversation with people that look like you, and I'm also prepared to get the, like, is it race question from white folks,
sure.
right? And it's
yeah.
a fair question, right? And to begin to dive into some numbers and, you know, to review some reports and briefs that we've all funded and paid for and read, and right? Like, I'm willing to go through that. I'm more prepared to go through that exercise with folks for whom that's not their lived experience or their professional experience, or that it's kind of a distant professional experience, you know, to the example that you provided with the board, right? And so I'm ready for that. When it's black folks, I am perplexed and a little bit hurt. And I think that the hurt comes in when it's like, because perhaps I'm an overthinker. Like, I'm like, but what is behind that, right? So you're asking this question, like, is it race? But what's behind that? Like, is this a fear response? And especially, I think, when it's more seasoned folks that I'm having this conversation with, because then I find myself feeling like I'm in a conversation with my parents. And, you know, I had two parents, married parents, which was a little bit of an anomaly for the neighborhood that I grew up in. And they both worked at the union, or they both were a part of their unions. My mom was a union rep and a union organizer. And so, you know, I grew up with a mother particularly, and a father who was really supportive, but that was really, really active. And you know, someone that I would consider an activist and an organizer. She was, you know, NAACP, Urban League, Coalition of Black Trade Unionists, A. Philip Randolph Institute. So, you know, I grew up on picket lines with my mom. And I remember my grandmother saying, like, don't have that baby out there, and, you know, that sort of thing. So it's like there is a fear that we have for our loved ones, our colleagues, our friends. And so sometimes, you know, it's funny to me when my mom, like, I remember when I was going to Ferguson, and she was really nervous. Like, she was just really fearful, because what she was watching on television and what together we were watching on television, and my father was, you know, really worried also, were military tanks driving down the streets of this tiny, tiny little suburb called Ferguson,
right,
and I'm getting on a plane to go down there, right, and so she's afraid. And I think that I wonder, as I sit in those sorts of conversations, like, well, perhaps they're fearful for me, right? Like, they are afraid for me to broach these kind of conversations. They are afraid for me professionally. They are perhaps afraid for me personally. Maybe it's an anxiety response. Maybe it's a response of frustration, right? That, you know, one of the members or the participants in this conversation shared that, you know, I lived through the Hough riots, and we've been talking about this thing for 50 years, and, like, you know, this conversation doesn't go anywhere. And so, you know, I guess the sadness sometimes that I feel is that that I want to know what's behind the resistance and the pushback, and that's hard to determine. But, you know, every time it happens, I guess there's at least an element of surprise. I'll say that much.
Well said. It certainly sounds like you have a history that almost required you to be as busy as you are.
A little bit, yeah. I blame it on my mom.
Okay.
All the time.
Yes.
That's right.
Absolutely.
That's right.
Mom did it.
Yeah.
The existence of microaggressions in everyday living, mm-hmm. which for folks of color, certainly for black folks in particular, is something that is lived with. I don't know that there's a moment that it's not lived with. Mm-hmm. But I wonder, as you do your work and as you talk to other people, and certainly black people, if there is an awareness of the microaggressions, or has it become so familiar that we're almost numb to it? We don't even know that we know it.
Unfortunately, I think the latter. In this framing document that one of my colleagues really brilliantly wrote for our organization that we share with the public, and, you know, it's available on our website, and we've shared it with a variety of audiences, we use the definition that describes microaggressions as the everyday verbal, nonverbal, and environmental slights, snubs, or insults, whether intentional or unintentional, which communicate hostile, derogatory, or negative messages to target persons based solely upon their marginalized group membership. So to your question, I think that it is become commonplace, unfortunately, for a lot of marginalized groups, particularly Black folks. I think that we have been taught conditioned to believe that those things are just how things are, right? Like, I remember being told growing up in Catholic schools, when in Rome, you do as Romans do. And I think that that has a lot of impact on, again, on your psychology, right? That,
absolutely.
Because you know it's wrong, right? Like, well, you know, I remember distinctly, you know, I met up with a group of friends that I, you know, went from as early as kindergarten with, and I talked about how difficult it was as a first grader to understand why you had to walk through the communion line, but you didn't get communion. And basically, you know, as a six-year-old, it's like, though that kid is getting a thing that I'm not getting. Why is that? Right? And then you think about it in retrospect, and hindsight is always 20/20, but that, like, our parents were making this sacrifice for us to get good education by putting us in Youngstown in Catholic school. You know, we didn't have sort of the educational options that other cities have, so it was public school or Catholic school. But it was a tough existence there. When you had everyone from classmates to other students to faculty and administration perpetuating these microaggressions. And I think that for a lot of people of color, if you really sit still and become introspective or retrospective about, like, what microaggressions you have experienced in your life, you likely will start somewhere back in kindergarten.
Indeed.
Or as early as, right, like, as your memory serves you. That certainly has been my experience, right? That, like, and you know, I think also to your question, you know, I think that not only has it become commonplace for us, we're not even, many of us are not familiar. I wasn't familiar with the term microaggression.
Evelyn, let me interrupt you for a moment.
Sure.
Because we've got a lot more to say about microaggressions, but right now we need to take a break. And when we come back, we will continue talking about microaggressions. I agree with you. A lot of people aren't even aware of what they're experiencing. Folks, Pamela Brewer, this is Mind Talk. We are looking at racism and the economic development, equality. We're looking at a lot of things as it affects how we are impacted in our daily breath with the fact of racism. We'll be right back. Evelyn, we were talking about microaggressions, and, you know, there are so many ways in which it shows up, and I certainly think you're right that it shows up very early on for persons of color, particularly Black persons in America, that there comes a point when you kind of don't want to hear it anymore, you don't want to pay attention to it anymore, you don't want to feel it anymore, and so you just bury the awareness. But I don't know that burying the awareness is really useful.
No.
In fact, I know it's not.
Mm-hmm.
Give us some more examples of what microaggressions look like in the everyday world.
For me, it looks like the jokes that you're supposed to laugh at that aren't funny. I think they look like the questions about your physical presence and by extension, your humanity. You know, the questions about hair, the questions about, you know, do you tan and can I touch it? And just the things that are just not that normal, and that the questioner or the person feeling perpetuating the microaggressions are insulted that you're insulted about the assumptions about the things that you should and shouldn't care about, the assumptions about the topics for which one could and could not have experience or expertise. You know, I recall a conversation when I had first moved back to Cleveland, you know, from New York, so I was feeling really worldly or, you know, whatever. And I was in a discussion about a public housing project here in Cleveland. It was something really simple, right? We work in community development, so safe streets is a part of our agenda. And there's a particular intersection that's like really, really dangerous for people that are crossing. And so my solution was, you know, we'd like to work with the city of Cleveland to adjust the walk signal, right? The walk signal is too short. And, you know, my argument for this is that many of the people that are needing to cross this intersection, which is like five or six lanes, are mothers with children and seniors. It's too short, right? And I walk this every day, so I was really familiar. And so I recall a white male in that meeting saying, like, Evelyn, like you, I grew up in the project, so I understand, you know, why this is a concern to you, but, like, here's my no for why this can't be done. And, you know, you sit in a meeting, and that is, for me, a microaggression, and was flabbergasting because, you know, my immediate response was, like, no, unlike me, right? I didn't grow up in the project. But just the assumption that, like, I care about these people must be because, you know, I am one of them in that way, and not because there is an inequality, an inequity, and an injustice occurring here, that has a pretty simple solution. And that, again, that disparity, and for me, it's this racial disparity, and that the example that I had cited prior to my, you know, proposed intervention was that a crosswalk had been added less than a fourth of a mile up that was for a more diverse serving group of commuters. But here, with these folks here, like, they just need to kind of speed it up, or this is not a possible intervention. And that, for me, is a microaggression, right? Just the assumptions that go along with it, the inability to serve those folks that look different, that have probably made some bad decisions which landed them there, or their inability to be resilient. Because in that particular example, what I found fascinating was this idea that, like, well, you know, like you, I also grew up in the projects, but look where I am now. You know, so it right. just, it can get very deep and complicated.
and nasty. On a lot of levels.
Yeah.
Your organization makes the distinction between racial justice and being anti-racist. Can you talk about that?
I actually think that we're still kind of struggling with the social justice and anti-racist. There's a really great, there are two examples. One, I remember, you know, growing up, my mom would always kind of quote different folks, and one of the folks that she would quote was Malcolm X, and, you know, when he would talk about, just because I'm pro-black doesn't mean I'm anti-white. And I think that what complicates these conversations is that when you try to look at the data, you will see often the conversation immediately goes to white guilt. It feels punitive. It feels like, you know, that was my ancestors. It wasn't me. I'm not that, you know, and it feels pretty accusatory. And I think that it's not really meant to do that. And so when we're talking about social justice and we're talking about equity particularly, we try to really rely on a lot of national research and data and other sources. There's a great one that I think the first time I saw was maybe the Cerner Foundation And it's this graphic of some people trying to view like a sporting event. And one person is shorter and one person is taller. And equality, which is a very, very, very American value, is that everybody deserves an equal share, intervention, support, whatever. So you would give each person, you know, a step ladder that has one rung. Where equity is really that if a person is shorter and you want them to be able to see the game as well, then their ladder might need four or five rungs, right? And that is less of a value that we all hold. And so I think that, you know, the social justice is really looking at a person's environment and the things that impact their ability to thrive, and committing to interventions that level that playing field and that help us achieve equity. You know, different from where, you know, it's challenging because I find myself in meetings sometimes saying we need to deal with hearts and minds if we want to get to change. And then from a more practical perspective, I find myself thinking, like, we can't do this heart and mind thing. Like, people just have to understand the repercussions of their actions and behaviors. And we all have to be committed to those repercussions. Because in most organizations, if you steal a pen, if you're late for work, if you know what the repercussions are, or the outcomes from those behaviors are. You don't know what happens if you are perpetuating systemically racist behavior, right? Because most organizations have some thing that say they don't tolerate any of that sort of thing,
right?
But you know, not a lot of specificity about what that means or what the outcomes of that behavior would be.
Well, actually, and you know, saying that you don't tolerate it and then engaging in it on a regular basis, knowingly
right.
or unknowingly. You know, it's kind of head twisting.
Yeah.
We started off with talking about looking at racial and social justices in technology. For those who are listening, who are perhaps looking at fields to go into, or perhaps family members, parents, so many times, I can't say whether it's more today than yesterday or what, but so many times what a young person will be told is, you can't do this because there aren't really opportunities for people who look like you, or that's not really your area, or no, why don't you do this other thing? But it sounds like there's something that you would like to say to Black folks in particular, but people in general, about racial and social justice issues within the technology field.
Yeah, I mean, I want us to become more engaged. There's a very clear digital divide in low-income communities of all races, and particularly low-income communities of color. But we are all consumers of technology. You know, this woman that I referenced earlier, Alia Rahman, you know, she started our social justice hackathon by just orienting folks to the fact that we all are consumers of technology. We all are. And she starts off, I recall, by like talking about a pen or a pencil. And that, like, at a time, that was technology. You know, that not all of us are holding smartphones in our hands, and not all of us are holding flip phones or landlines, but, you know, the vast majority of us have one of those things, a landline. You know, the vast majority of us have cable, we have a television, we have, right, like, all these things are technology. We sit in a car, we're on a bus that has Wi-Fi, right? And that we all are entitled to evolve with our with the times, with our economy. The economy is becoming increasingly digital, and this could be, you know, I believe that there is no evolution or revolution that has evolved as rapidly as the digital economy evolution, and so it's going to be very, very, very easy for us to be left behind. And you're absolutely right. You nailed it, that you know, we've talked to a couple parents. There's a lot of coding boot camps and programming and just technology supports around Cleveland. And we talked to Black parents particularly, and they kind of have this sentiment of like, oh, well, my kid can't do that, right? Like, my kid's not
smart
X enough for that. And that's tricky. And we have to really unlearn, right? Like, we have to help folks believe differently and understand this digital evolution in a very different way. Similar to, you know, growing up in Youngstown, Ohio, you know, the best job for your kid to get into was something in the auto industry. And, you know, a generation before me, or, you know, it was to get into some form of manufacturing, right? Steel mill, whatever. And folks kind of understood the skill sets necessary for that. And I think that because the digital economy is rapidly evolving, and it's pretty new for a lot of us, and it feels pretty futuristic and like you're watching an episode of The Jetsons or something, you know, we haven't been able to get the level of tangibility that we need. Like, so what does it mean to be a coder? What does it mean to be a programmer? What does it mean to be a computer engineer? Does this require a degree? Does this require a master's degree? Does this just require a 15-week coding boot camp? How much is that coding boot camp? Like, how do I access these things? So we're really trying to focus a lot on educating folks about what's out there, and then, like, kind of clearing some of the noise, because I think there is a little bit of rhetoric out there, you know, for the bleeding hearts of us that are saying, oh, you don't really need X type of education to be a coder. Well, you know, there's some skill sets that you need to hone and refine to do different types of work. But I think the biggest takeaway, you know, is that for us to pay attention and get involved and then recognize where we are making incredible solutions. It sounds, you know, juvenile, but I remind a lot of colleagues that are experts in the tech space that there's an app that I see on like Instagram or and Facebook and other social media platforms that's called Beyonce on Beat. And these kids create it, and they basically can, like, at Beyonce concerts, she is on beat to any song they put it to. That is deep levels of programming and coding, right?
Okay.
And so we have to be able to also recognize our contributions. And it seems passe, but it's not. It's, like, very high skill levels. And just the things that you see kids and adults doing on social media and other, you know, kind of non-traditionally recognized platforms, we have to recognize our contributions to this evolution and see ourselves in it as well.
Evelyn, I am so saddened to have to say that we have come to the end of our time, because I could actually talk to you for another 4 or 5 hours.
Oh.
So I may have to have you back if that's okay with you, putting you on the spot. But Evelyn, I do want to ask you to share with the audience a place where they can get more information about what's going on in Cleveland and the work that you folks do with your organization.
Sure, and I appreciate that. For Hack Cleveland, you could visit our website. It's hackcleveland.org. And there's a lot of evolution with that organization, which is really, really exciting stuff. Also for Cleveland Neighborhood Progress and some of the work happening in community development, and we're trying to make our website a more robust place for information. It's ClevelandNP, as in neighborhoodprogress.org. And, you know, from there, it also, obviously, our social media feeds for both organizations, I think, can help folks get a sense of some of the stuff we're trying to pay attention to here locally.
Excellent. Evelyn Burnett, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you for the work that you do. And again, thank you in advance for coming back to talk to us some more.
Thank you. I'm honored to have the opportunity to speak with you.
You see how I snuck that in there? Folks, thank you for joining us on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to take the place of any work that you may choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available to you on demand at myndtalk.org. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. And folks, if you'd like to be in touch with me, me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. But the best way to be in touch is simply by going to mindtalk.org. Again, that's mindtalk.org. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. Take care.